This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Julie Lithcott-Hames, is a best-selling author whose work has a lot to say about personal growth. Her 2015 book, How to Raise an Adult, warns parents about micromanaging their kids' lives, which can prevent them from developing the independence and resilience they'll need as adults. Her 2017 memoir, Real American, is the moving story of her coming to terms with her racial identity. Her father was a prominent African-American physician, her mother a white British woman. Lithcott-Hames' new book is aimed at young people just emerging into the grown-up world. It's a handbook of sorts on adulthood, offering insights and strategies on education and career choices, building friendships, coping with setbacks, staying physically and mentally healthy, managing money, and more. It's called Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. Julie Lithcott-Hames is the former dean of freshman and undergraduate advising at Stanford, where she earned her BA. She also earned a law degree from Harvard and a master's in fine arts and writing from California College of the Arts. She joins us from her home in Palo Alto. Julie Lithcott-Hames, welcome to Fresh Air. Your memoir, I have to say, this is a really powerful read, and it's a coming-of-age story. A lot of it is about wrestling with racial identity. Let's just talk about your family. Tell us about your father first.
My father was born in the Jim Crow South in 1918. He would have been 102 if he was still alive. He emerged out of that incredibly racialized environment, went to college at Bates, went to med school at BU, became the first black professor at a medical school south of the Mason-Dixon line in the 1950s. Went off to West Africa to help eradicate smallpox, became the Assistant Surgeon General of the United States under President Jimmy Carter, and I'm the product of his second marriage to my mother, a white British lady.
And they met in Africa. How did she get there?
Well, my mother left England as a 22-year-old. She was fleeing a difficult circumstance there and got a teaching job in Ghana, teaching math and science to nursing students. My father was a diplomat doing this work around public health in Ghana, and they met at a party, and they sat on a couch and talked for hours and fell in love, and they were together from that night until the night that my father died in 1995.
You were born in Nigeria, right?
I was. They moved from Ghana to Nigeria, and that's where I was born, yeah.
Yeah, and you came to the States when you were young. You lived in Manhattan for a while, then to a community in, I guess, near Palisades, New York, right?
Right.
Do you remember as a child noticing differences in the way white people reacted to your father from your mother?
Absolutely. I remember being three or four, walking down a sidewalk in our town, holding my daddy's hand, and a white man walked toward us with a sneer on his face, such an angry look that it frightened me. It looked to be the face of a snarling dog, but it was simply a man. And I gripped Daddy's hand for reassurance, and I looked up at him, but he didn't look down at me. He just gripped my hand tighter and pursed his lips and kept walking. And I think in some ways, being a kid of a white person and a black person allowed me to A/B test of racism or interactions with strangers. Nobody looked at my mother with that snarling, angry face. They looked at her sometimes with pity and disdain, but there wasn't the anger when she was holding my hand. And I couldn't have called it racism when I was four, but I knew I was meant to be afraid, and I was.
Wow. That memory stays with you from the age of four?
Absolutely.
Wow. You write that in kindergarten, or maybe first grade, you say you were learning that something might be wrong with you, and kids would ask, what are you, and express surprise that your mom was white. And you would mention this to your parents. What did they say?
You know, my parents were choosing to raise me in white communities, and that was a decision my dad made. He was, as I said, a product of the Jim Crow South. He was determined to be unfettered by racism. He had experienced 7 years of freedom in West Africa as a black man where his skin color did not hold him back, and now he had returned to the United States. My parents tried to reassure me that you are black, you are beautiful. Every parent of a mixed race child is told, tell them they're black because the world will see them as black and they need to grow up proud of that identity. And so my parents were there with that rhetoric. but I didn't understand it. I had this white mother, and it was clear to me that the world valued her more than my black daddy. So I was wondering, as a seven-year-old, why isn't mommy using her whiteness to rescue me and daddy from this pit it appears we have fallen into because of our skin color?
The pit being what?
The pit of unworthiness. I mean, by seven, I think I had consumed enough media, enough messaging. I was preferring white dolls. I was preferring white stories. I mean, I was like any, it sounds so awful to say this. I mean, I'm now this 53-year-old self-loving black woman, but I'm dipping back into those early stories and trying to tell the truth of them, which is I knew by seven that something was wrong with blackness. And I thought, I have this white mother, so maybe we're a little better since we have this white family member.
You write that your mom was the blackest white lady you knew, maybe even the blackest person you knew. In what way?
So mom was this 22-year-old who left England for West Africa and was embraced there by Ghanaians and by Nigerians, really came into her own in West Africa and moved to America with my father in 1969. And for the first time then, as a 30-year-old, discovered American racism. The dresses she wore were made of fabrics she'd bought in West Africa. So my mother had a consciousness around blackness, around blackness being beautiful. And she was bringing that into our home in America, trying to raise this black biracial daughter of hers to be self-loving. She was saying all the right things. She was putting up posters of black girls and women in my childhood bedroom. She was bringing me A Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats, the first children's book to feature a black character. And yet, I felt it was performative. I knew something was wrong with blackness. I had been taught that. And I felt a growing annoyance. Here's my white mother trying to tell me I'm black. She didn't know what to do with my hair. My hair was this mess of tumbleweed. There weren't products then. And she didn't know how to deal with black hair either. And so I just felt odd. I felt like an other.
There are so many moments that you describe in the book where you run up against white racism, you know, in small moments, subtle ways. I mean, I guess what people often call microaggressions nowadays. I wanted you to just share one little story with us. This is, you were in fifth grade, and there was this teacher, Mr. Polanski, right? And there was a question of, are you going to get into the gifted and talented group in the grade? Tell us this story.
Polanski is a pseudonym, as you might expect. Yes, I was in fifth grade at Lake Ann Elementary School in Reston, Virginia. This is when Daddy had just gotten his position as Assistant Surgeon General for the Carter administration. So my best friend Susie gets pulled into Gifted and Talented. This is a predominantly white school. Susie is white. And Susie and I are best friends, and Susie is very smart, and I also know that I'm smart, and I know Susie's not any smarter than I am. So she gets pulled into Gifted and Talented, and it looks awesome. She gets to do cool projects and puzzles, and I'm a little jealous. So I go home to my mom, and I say, you know, Susie got pulled into this new thing they have called Gifted and Talented, question mark. And my mom looks back at me, sort of question mark, and she says, that doesn't sound right. I mean, yes, Susie should be there, but why not you? And so she goes to Polanski, and she talks about it, but Polanski is not persuaded. And so my mom escalates to the principal. And this is where my mother's privilege as a white woman, as a very educated person herself, shows up and is of use to me. And she insists that I be tested, and they do test me. They give me an IQ test, and they mail the results to our house. And mom thinks I'm not watching when she opens the envelope and reads it and squirrels it away in a drawer. And I get put in the gifted group soon after. And then shortly after that, at an assembly for our whole grade, Mr. Polanski says, to nobody in particular, to the entire room before the assembly starts, he just folds his arms across his chest and he announces, apparently all it takes to be gifted is for your parent to meet with the principal. And I knew he was talking about me, and I knew he was talking to me. But Dave, I had peeked at the letter from the district, which said I was in the 99th percentile. Damn, I wish I didn't have tears in my voice right now, because I'm 53 and I'd like to be over this hurt, this slight that I experienced in the fifth grade. And in the fifth grade, I sat there and looked at Polanski, and I didn't say this out loud, but in my head, I uttered a very silent F you, because I knew what he was doing. And I learned in that moment, some teachers are not going to see what I'm capable of because of my race. They're not going to see it. And I am going to have to prove myself every single time.
It's remarkable because, you know, when you're in fifth grade, you're what, 10, 11? You could be crushed by that, you know. Is he right? Or I resent my mom coming to see the principal. You didn't. You said, up yours. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, no. You know, I wasn't crushed. That is, it fueled me. It gave me a velocity that said, you better make sure this doesn't happen to you again. But I was crushed in a different sense. I learned more about humans. I learned that some humans are unkind and disrespectful. I lost a bit more innocence about how humans can be.
I guess you were 10 when you moved to the Washington area where your father went to work for in the Carter administration as an assistant surgeon general. You moved to Northern Virginia where there was some diversity among your friends and mates and classmates. But after Ronald Reagan won the election in 1980, your dad was out of a job and he got an academic post in Wisconsin, and you moved to a suburban neighborhood outside Madison, where, as you describe it, you know, the middle school and high school were overwhelmingly white. And, you know, what's awful about this is that in adolescence, when you're a teenager, is maybe more than any other time in our lives, we, you know, there's such peer pressure, and we really just want to fit in, right? I mean, you be what other people around us are like, and that was just so impossible for you. You know, you're living in this world surrounded by all these white kids. And of course there are, I mean, you said essentially in the paper that the only black people you saw on a regular basis were your family. On the other hand, there were a lot of media images of African Americans. And I'm wondering kind of how all that affected you and your sense of yourself.
Yeah, I think the media was this ping pong. It was either the stereotype of blackness that was routinely showing up in the news about us being violent or lazy or, you know, just all of these stereotypes. And on the other side, there was the Cosby Show. The Cosby Show debuted while I was in high school. And as problematic as the legacy of that show may be, it was a lifeline for me as a black kid growing up in the cornfields of Wisconsin, where everyone and everything was white. And I was searching for clues about how I was supposed to think and talk and what I was supposed to care about. It was a touchstone to blackness. Now, of course, it was an upper middle class family, which was also our status. I mean, it was a very privileged black family, which I'm well aware is not the typical black experience. Nevertheless, it did mirror my experience. So the media became this push and pull. I was trying not to be, never to be the stereotypical black person, constantly trying to prove my worth, prove my smarts, prove that I wasn't trying to steal from somebody in a store, you know, or that I wasn't bad. I was desperately running from the stereotype and running toward this sort of model, this idealized version of blackness.
You were accepted to Stanford, and you write that college you hoped would be your chance to make black friends, even learn how to, quote, be black, unquote. And, you know, when you got there during student orientation, you saw a flyer to a welcome event sponsored by the Black Community Services Center. There was a kind of an African-American-centered dormitory, and a lot of kids stayed there. You decide to go. What was the experience like?
I walked up to this dorm lounge. I could see through the window a whole lot of black and brown kids who seemed to already know each other. There was laughter. There was just sort of a relaxed vibe. And I longed for that. But I also felt instantly like an outsider. I thought, how do these kids already know each other? Aren't we all freshmen? And I just worried. I worried I don't have what it takes to interact with black kids. I don't know black kids. I don't know how to be black. They're going to know I have a white mother. They're going to know I grew up in white spaces. That internalized oppression was just shouting at me, you don't belong. You don't belong. You don't belong. I knew I wasn't white, but I was also pretty sure by that time of life that I wasn't black either. It looked like this enticing treehouse in the woods, and I was climbing the ladder and, you know, wanting to be let in, but couldn't even bring myself to knock at the door. I mean, I did go in, but I just felt really really out of place. I thought they were rejecting me. In hindsight, what I can tell you is I was showing up with such a look of, I don't belong. I'm afraid you won't like me. I'm afraid I'm not Black enough. I was showing up with that vibe oozing out of my pores, probably screaming out of my eyes, that the looks that I saw as rejection from the Black community, from students in the Black community that I was encountering, were really this sort of internalized self-rejection. And I know that because once I became this self-loving Black person who was no longer ashamed to be so light-skinned and have this white mother, the Black community was there to embrace me. And folks said, hey, we've been waiting for you all along. Welcome.
It took a long time to get there, I know.
It did. But boy, was it the most loving embrace I've ever experienced.
There's a painful section here, which I'm just going to read this, where you write that much later, you write that what you now know to have been true of yourself in childhood and young adult. One, I hated being Black. Two, I was afraid of Black people. Three, I tried to be what white people valued. I will just tell readers that the journey to your coming to a different perspective on all this is fascinating reading, and we won't have time to go through all of it here. Is there a moment that you could share that was important in that journey?
Yeah. So what you've just shared is probably the most vulnerable writing I have ever put to page and published in a book. And I felt it was essential because it was my truth and because it was the pivot point for me. I said those things out loud before putting them in the pages of a book, and I am probably sobbing in the most ugly way as I say these things. Because I feel, first of all, that I'm the only person who's ever felt this way about my own people. And I'm so ashamed. And then what happens is, it's like I've released it from me. I realize that this racism, this internalized oppression that made me feel those things, had a clamp on my heart, on my psyche. And what I've effectively done is it's been like a bully that's been holding on to me, and that I finally turned around and faced it and said, stop it. And when I had the guts to say that out loud to someone I trusted and to myself, I made the bully run away. And that self-loathing was replaced within an instant by self-love. And the best way I can describe it to you is the next day I came to work, and I'm working on the Stanford campus. I know tons of people. There are a lot of Black folks on the campus, folks I've known for quite some time, students, faculty, staff. And it's like every Black person got a memo saying, will you smile at Julie today? And I think what was happening was I was finally smiling at myself. I was finally this self-loving Black person saying, you know what? It's not about what white people think. I am a person who's worthy of being treated with dignity and kindness. Black people are amazing humans. And I was saying that to myself. So now as I'm walking through the world and encountering Black folks, my eyes are saying the same thing to them, which is why I'm getting smiles back. It was the most beautiful transformation. And I know listeners may have a hard time understanding, and yet I know there are listeners nodding their heads with understanding, because if you have been a member, if you are a member of a marginalized group and you have felt that degree of internalized oppression, you know what that feels like, and you are longing for that liberation, and it is available to you when you just turn and face what has been done to you and decide, you know what, I am in charge. I'm not going to let them define how I feel about myself.
You know, your father died several decades ago, I guess, right? You were in your 20s. You did talk to your mom about some of these issues and the difficulty that you had growing up in this white community, in this white high school. Can you tell us about that conversation?
My amazing mother, Jean Lithcott, 82 years old, and we've chosen to conjoin our lives, live together, to try to afford living in Silicon Valley. And so we are a part of each other's daily lives. And for that reason, as I have come to this place of self-love as a Black woman and come to terms with an upbringing that was quite flawed in many ways, although I know my parents were doing their best in choosing to raise me in predominantly white, almost exclusively white communities at times, It harmed me, and I have needed them to know. The person I need to take it up with is Daddy. I think Daddy is the parent who probably should have known better, but as I've said, I couldn't. I didn't even know to have this conversation. I didn't have this consciousness before he died. So I've taken it all out on my white mother, which I say with a chuckle, but also with a lot of compassion. Mom was the only parent here as I was doing this work, and boy, did I go at it with her. And to her credit, all my mother has ever wanted is for her Black daughter to love her Black self. She has wanted that for me since I was born. And so she has this profound delight that I have arrived at this place. And what she will say to me through tears is, I was doing the best that I could. And I am able to say through tears, Mom, I know you did. I know you were doing the best you could. So we have had that reckoning, and it wasn't one conversation. It was many conversations. Mom began quite defensive. And of course, that just fueled my anger. And we have now moved through that and gotten to a place where we can accept that we've lived very different life experiences. For a while, my mother, I think, felt, you know, I married your father, I've given birth to you, I am white, but I am not that typical white person. And I've said, yes, but Mom, when the Ku Klux Klan is marching, you know, in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, they're coming for people who look like me, not for people who look like you. Your whiteness shields you from that, even though you love Black people in the deepest part of your bones. You are not Black, and we do have different experiences, and I really would like for you to acknowledge that. It doesn't mean you love me any less, but please don't purport to have the same experience I do. That's been an important conversation. I think that's a conversation any white parent who's got multiracial kids or transracially adopted kids of color, that white parent needs to understand, you know, you can have compassion, and you must, but you are not walking the same path as your children.
Well, Julie Lithcott-Hames, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Dave, thank you so much. What an honor and a pleasure. Thank you.
Julie Lithcott-Hames' new book is Your Turn, How to Be an Adult. Her 2017 memoir is called Real American. Lithcott-Hames is also the author of the 2015 bestseller, How to Raise an Adult. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album by alto saxophonist Vincent Herring, who Kevin describes as operating squarely in the jazz mainstream, the perfect setting for his talents. Last year, Herring recorded an album that he began before he caught COVID-19 and completed after he recovered. Kevin says Herring sounds strong throughout.
Vincent Herring on Minor Swing by his pianist Cyrus Chestnut, from Herring's aptly named Preaching to the Choir. It's aimed at folks who like their jazz with a dollop of swing rhythm and blues feeling, music steeped in the African-American vernacular and played by a soloist with swagger. You can hear what Vincent Herring gets from Fleet Charlie Parker and soaring John Coltrane, but he adds his own bold strokes. He's got great timing. His improvised phrases sting and float. Herring plays the standard Old Devil Moon over a fatback beat copped from Benny Golson's tune Killer Joe. That's Yasushi Nakamura on bass. Thank you. Vincent Herring's swagger is matched by his imposing tone on alto. He might play a hair sharp to really make his line stand out. His blaring long tones are bright stripes painted across the face of the music. Herring can also simmer down. On Duke Ellington's ballad In a Sentimental Mood, he still plays busy phrases, but knows where to place them. The rhythm trio melts away there, but they're usually assertive. On piano, Cyrus Chestnut has the right instincts about when to lay back and when to lean in behind Vincent Herring's horn. Like the leader, Chestnut plays blues that are both slick and elemental in good ways. Behind their solos, drummer Jonathan Blake adds supportive comments and tumbling triplets that roll the music on. Cyrus Chestnut working in a quote from Work Song by Vincent Herring's old boss, Nat Adderley. The album Preaching to the Converted includes a fast Latin tune by another Herring employer, Cedar Walton, a couple of Herring originals, a Stevie Wonder standard, and Lionel Richie's lovelorn weeper, Hello, where alto saxophone gives the melody a purifying acid bath. The best straight-ahead jazz feels timeless. Its core principles have been in place 60 years and more, but within that idiom, inspired improvisers keep making fresh, personal statements over song forms, old or new. Mainstream jazz has its formulas, but for thinking players, its resources and subtleties are all but inexhaustible. Good for another 60 years, easy.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the book Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed Preaching to the Choir by alto saxophonist Vincent Herring. 96 million Americans are obese today, and our guest Michael Moss wrote in a 2013 bestseller that giant food companies contributed to the problem with their aggressive marketing of heavily processed foods loaded with salt, sugar, and fat. When asked at the time if those products were addictive, like drugs, he didn't have a clear answer. He returns to that question in a new book that updates the food industry's efforts to keep us buying their products in large quantities and explores the food giants' responses to pressure from consumers and health advocates to change their offerings. Michael Moss is an investigative reporter who formerly worked for the New York Times, where he won a Pulitzer Prize for his investigation into the dangers of contaminated meat. He's also worked at the Wall Street Journal, the Atlanta Constitution, and other publications. His new book is Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. He joins us from his home in Brooklyn, New York. Michael Moss, welcome back to Fresh Air. So in this book, you look at the notion of addiction and whether processed food can be said to be addicting. So let's just talk a little bit about how our biology interacts with the processed food that a lot of the food giants sell. Now, I mean, it's known that we've evolved to love food with high sugar and fat content because our ancestors, our prehistoric ancestors, needed, you know, to maximize fuel and food storage in a different era. But in this book, you explore some other aspects of our biology that might compel us to eat this stuff. One of them is the role of memory in the way we choose our food. Do you want to explore this with us?
Yeah, so one of the reasons I came to think that some of these food products are even more powerful, more troublesome than drugs can be, is memory. You know, what we eat is all about memory, and we begin forming memories for food at a really early age, possibly even in the womb, depending on what our mother is eating. And we keep those memories for a lifetime. They don't go away. And the more we sort of do and the more we eat these products, the deeper the kind of those memory channels go. And so the food industry, knowing that, spends lots of time trying to shape the memories that we have for their products. And it's why the soda companies discovered that if they put a soda in the hands of a child when they're at a ballpark with their parents, that soda will forever be associated with that joyous moment. Because that's the thing about food memories, that they often get associated with memories. And so, or with other emotions, I should say. And so later on in life, when that child now wants to, you know, experience a joyous moment, they're going to think of soda and associate it with that. And one of the ways that memory kind of played out just recently, I mean, during the pandemic, we at least thought we were going to get away from the vending machine, one of the most treacherous corners of the processed food industry. But many people turned their kitchen cupboards into vending machines because we went shopping. And under the stress and strain of the pandemic, we went into the store and we started buying products we hadn't had since we were kids. And the companies were elated because the sales of those products were soaring, and they continue to as we bought those products. And the reason we did is that we remembered them from our childhood and sort of great joyous moments. And 30, 40 years later, those memories weren't disappeared. We were buying those products and bringing them home.
And it's interesting that it's the association is not just with soda or a candy bar, but with the brands that you had this wonderful experience with. And then the triggers can come back years, decades later, right? I mean, you know, I remember when I saw the movie Super Size Me, which is about the guy who eats at McDonald's three meals a day for a month. Not a flattering portrayal of McDonald's. One of my reactions was, ooh, I haven't had a Big Mac in forever. I want one.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I had an experience like that too, because I went to the research and development factory of Kellogg's in Battle Creek, Michigan, to talk to them about something else. And as we were walking through, they were experimenting with a new version of Pop-Tarts, and the production line had failed, and they were dumping a huge amount into a vat. But that aroma wafting across the factory floor took me instantly back to grammar school. I was a latchkey kid, and one of my joyous moments of the day was coming home, letting myself in and putting a Pop-Tart in the toaster oven. So, you know, and I hadn't had a Pop-Tart in 30, 40 years since then, but simply the power of the smell and the memory of that was enough to whisk me all the way back to my childhood.
Another part of our biology that works here is the mechanics of smell. There's a little more to it than we'd realized, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that happened when we became, and for this book, I spent time with evolutionary biologists, which was sort of an incredible experience for me because they have this perspective on us. And in fact, one of them kind of pushed back on the addiction thing and said, look, Michael, it's not so much that food is addictive, is that we by nature are drawn toward food in ways that cause us to love food and even want to overeat. And the problem is that these food companies have changed the nature of our food in the past 50 years to make overeating an everyday thing. And so one of the ways that we're drawn to food, when we began standing upright, walking upright, it was sort of enhanced our powers of smell. And so today we smell not only through the nose, but through the mouth. And when we chew or sip drinks, the volatiles get released, and there's kind of like a little chimney in the back of your mouth that takes those smell molecules up to kind of your nasal cavity. The olfactory bulb sits at the bottom of the brain and gets the brain excited, to which, when we think of flavor, 80% of flavor is actually smell, not taste. Taste being salt, sugar, fat, umami, sour, picked up by the taste buds. We can smell from 350 to 380 different things and sort of thousands of combinations.
Right. And so do food companies in their research labs use that in some way to increase the appeal of their foods?
Oh my gosh, do they? So they use these chemical labs called flavor houses, which run up and down New Jersey, actually the corridor there, working for the food companies, because there you have chemists, flavorists, who know how to maximize the smell of products to imitate sort of natural smells and flavor. And one of these houses walked me through the process of creating pumpkin pie spice, right? Which became kind of this crazy thing in the supermarket during the fall after Starbucks started it with coffee. Suddenly you saw pumpkin spice Pop-Tarts and M&Ms and cereals and on and on and on. But one of the really fascinating things about their work is while they're driving to maximize smell, one of the most valuable things they do for the processed food industry is to reduce the cost of their products.
So that's where smell comes in. You can make them more flavorful more cheaply by using smell rather than taste.
Yes, and those same chemists who are working on the smell are also reformulating and paying even more attention to making smells at a lower cost for the food products.
You also write about speed. This somehow is connected to the speed with which sugar on our tongue hits the brain and gets us excited.
Yeah, one of the hallmarks of addiction that scientists who were studying drug addiction discovered back in the 1990s was that the faster a substance hits the brain, the more apt we are as a result to act compulsively, impulsively. So they sort of speak about, you know, tobacco and alcohol and drug products in terms of the speed that they hit the brain. But it turns out that there's nothing faster than food in the way its ability to sort of hit the brain. And some scientists did this really neat experiment a while ago where they sat people down and they said, look, we want to test how fast you taste sweetness. So we're going to put a little sugar on your tongue. And when you taste it, you push the button. And so sugar goes on the tongue and it cheats. It doesn't go directly to the brain. It sends a signal, gets picked up by the taste buds, which activate the sweet receptors in the taste buds, which sends a signal to the brain. In their case, their brain was telling that finger to push the button in less than a second. I think it was about 6/10, 7/10 of a second. Compared to smoking, which can take 10 seconds to fully activate the brain, and alcohol and narcotics are kind of somewhere in between. But for me, this put kind of the notion of fast food in an entirely new light. In fact, I like to call what we're talking about here fast groceries, that 90% of the middle part of the grocery store where we find these things, because everything about the processed food industry is about speed. From the manufacturing to the packaging, making it easy for us to open up those packages and get at the food, to the actual speed of their products exciting our brains.
Wow. So the fact that food will hit our brain more quickly than cocaine or heroin or alcohol or nicotine means we're more likely to reach for it repeatedly?
Yeah, I think so. And one of the pushbacks, again, from the industry that I had in starting the research was, but wait a minute, if you look at brain scans of people, one person's on cocaine, another person is on, you know, Hot Pockets, the brain's not going to be lighting up as brightly for the Hot Pockets as the cocaine. But as drug researchers, drug addiction researchers who now study food addiction pointed out to me, you know, food doesn't have to work that hard on us to get us to act compulsively, kind of because of the food environment. It's inexpensive, it's legal, it's everywhere, and the advertising from the companies is cueing us to remember those products and want those products sort of constantly. So the food environment, along with memory and speed, is sort of one of those key things that makes food even more problematic for so many people, even more so than drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes.
Are the food companies guilty of knowingly marketing an addictive product?
I have to tell you, Dave, that, you know, I've been crawling through this industry for 10 years now, and I still resist the idea of looking at them as this evil empire that intentionally set out to make us obese or otherwise ill on their products, right? These are companies doing what all companies want to do, right? Make as much money. But I think one of the problems, too, is that, you know, the problem lies in kind of their own dependence on making their products, you know, inexpensive and super yummy and incredibly convenient for us. And now that more and more people are caring about what they put in their bodies and are wanting to eat healthier, these companies are finding it really difficult to meet that new demand because of their own addiction, if you will, to making these convenience foods.
You know, you describe visiting food research labs in this book and in your previous book, and it made me wonder what your relationships with people in this industry are like. I mean, both this book and your previous book are pretty tough, you know, on the food manufacturers. I don't know. Do they talk to you?
I think that privately they perhaps wish I'd never been born, but by and large, I think they've seen my reporting as being really tough, but also fair and accurate. But more than that, having the documents, their own internal documents, describing how they engineer and formulate and market these products, it was those documents that enabled me to kind of find and meet people in the industry. And I have to say, one of the surprising things about this too is how many of them have come to have misgivings about their life work. Seeing how our dependency on their products has grown over the years in a way that maybe they didn't really intend when they invented things like the Lunchables or the Hot Pockets or so many of these fast groceries in the grocery store. And I think they were also sort of open to my take on this, which is not to write books that are like screeds or attacking them, but just kind of, for me, it's like a detective story. It's like, how do they do it? How did they get us so hooked on our products that we lose our free will and our ability to say no? And I think they sort of appreciate that just kind of basic journalistic approach to looking at their work.
Can you give us an example of someone in the industry who thought differently about their work?
Yeah, so I met the inventor of the Lunchables, Bob Drain, who in the very beginning wanted to add things like sliced carrots and sliced apples to the Lunchables, but realized that they couldn't figure out, you know, how to keep those things fresh when the Lunchables had to go to the warehouse for weeks or months at a time and then sit in the grocery shelf. I mean, he talked to me because he realized that our dependency on processed food had grown, you know, incredibly over the years. And having invented that in a much more innocent era, he also discovered sort of inside his own family, I think he had two boys and one girl, and his daughter refused to sort of serve Lunchables to her children, his grandkids. And I think that was a moment of awakening for him as well. But he's one of these insiders in the processed food industry that has left and has begun helping alternative food inventors sell their products in ways that kind of make sense for the grocery store. And the last time I talked to him, he was helping the inventor of a vending machine that sells fresh salads come up with kind of novel marketing ways, using kind of the tricks and the trades from the processed food industry to help sort of market those things on a national basis.
So remind us, what are Lunchables?
Oh, Lunchables were this creation by Kraft, trays of processed meat and cheese and crackers, and then they came up with different versions that ultimately were marketed to kids as a bring-from-home lunch they could eat at school. And the fascinating thing about it is that the company itself sort of acknowledged publicly that they weren't so much about the food, because they even made like a cold pizza Lunchables. And when parents were asked, you know, in trials, whether they thought their kids would like those, the parents said, "Are you kidding? Cold pizza? Who in the world would like that?" But what Kraft realized, it was not so much about the food, the ingredients, but the empowerment. Lunchables were designed in a way that would make those kids, you know, be the cat's meow when they pulled those out of their book satchels in the lunchroom, and other kids would be envious of them. So in so many ways, Lunchables was kind of an example of kind of the emotional power that these processed food products have over us and in our lives.
Status is a piece of cold processed pizza. Wow.
Yeah. And so they came up with the slogan, right? Which is, you know, all day you got to do what they say, but lunchtime is all yours.
Well, Michael Moss, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Really great talking to you, and thank you so much for having me.
Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. His new book is Hooked: Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions.